Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. A brief moment on pandemic winners and losers, a quick break for Mexican food, and a detour to the wonders of capital expenditures. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 21st day of April. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. We begin today and insert all appropriate caveats about consulting your own financial professional here, please. But we begin today with what's known in the parlance as the stay-home trade. Companies that have thrived these past 14 months because we're working at home and working out at home and relaxing at home. You might think Zoom and Peloton and Netflix in that category, all of which have been having not great runs of late as we all start staying home less and less. And sure enough, in reporting earnings this week, Netflix said in the first quarter of the year it added way fewer subscribers than anybody had been expecting. A far cry, I think you'll agree, from when everybody was watching Tiger King and the Queen's Gambit. So, what happens next for the streamers and for the rest of them who have moved a ton of product during the lockdowns? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gets us going.
So you've heard this part before. Lots of products and businesses saw sales go through the roof during this pandemic. We were stuck at home, and we bought a lot of paint and furniture and exercise equipment and groceries.
But, you know, now that discretionary income that went towards that is going to start to go more and more towards travel and leisure.
Randy Burt is a managing director at Alex Partners. He says air travel is recovering. People want to be out in the world. And
everybody has a limit to what they can spend, and so they have to make a choice.
And when faced with a choice between, say, new flooring and a trip to Puerto Rico, someone who's been stuck at home for a year might lean towards the trip. But predicting how much sales of things for the home will drop, if they'll drop, that gets a little complicated. Denise Dalhoff is a senior researcher at the Conference Board.
I don't see that all those categories will be suffering with people going back more to public life, because people also adopted more new habits in the pandemic, and some of them will linger.
For instance, a lot of people who are currently working from home plan to continue, which means they'll still have those moments where they're staring at that cracked, stained tile floor like, I just can't look at this anymore. So home improvement might do okay. Eric Easter is CEO of Kittle's Home Furnishings, a furniture and mattress store in Indianapolis. He says another thing working in his company's favor, the savings rate, is at an all-time high.
People's individual balance sheets are stronger than they've been in many, many years. So yes, they can probably take a trip, but they can also afford some new furniture.
At least that's his hope. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
The big industrial hope in this economy right now is semiconductors, getting lots and lots of semiconductors. Because as we've been telling you, the lack of them has been slowing down production of everything from cars to computers to appliances. Ford said today, actually, that it's going to keep 5 assembly plants across North America closed for an extra 2 weeks. They're already closed. They're going to close an extra 2 weeks, including a plant that makes the F-150 pickup, Ford's biggest moneymaker. The Biden administration has been trying to raise the red flag. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo told a Senate committee yesterday that our chip supply chain is, and these are her words, a national security risk and an economic security risk. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on that one.
Here's the issue with semiconductors. They're in everything, including military equipment, and we don't have enough of them. The U.S. dominates in designing them, but doesn't make the most advanced ones. The most cutting-edge semiconductors are made in Taiwan.
Yes, it's not mainland China, but should we rely so much on a single company to be able to manufacture these advanced chips?
Damian Ma heads the Macro Polo Institute think tank. President Biden's infrastructure package has $50 billion in it to boost the U.S. chip industry. It's a lot of money, but not in semiconductor world.
It's not going to like move the needle that much.
Stacey Razgon is a semiconductor analyst at Bernstein Research. He says, look at what the global leader, Taiwan-based TSMC, is doing.
TSMC, which is a single company, is getting ready to spend $100 billion over the next 3 years versus like $50 billion in the U.S. over, you know, multiple years for the entire U.S. semiconductor industry. I mean, it's not that big.
Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo said that money would be matched with multiple times that amount in private spending. But Razgon says building up a U.S. manufacturing capacity needs more than money. He says you need immigration and education reform to staff a bunch of plants. And turning inward isn't the whole solution, according to Tatiana Bolton with the R Street Institute.
The answer is not completely onshoring semiconductors and every other item that we make across the world.
She says the U.S. just needs to maintain some minimum viable amount of manufacturing capacity and then go to allies.
Using our allies and partners in a network of interconnected manufacturing and production so that we are secure.
$50 billion is, she says, a start. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, the stay-home trade might not be working out so well right now, but the reopening trade, oh, it is all good there. And I cannot stress this enough, by the way, do not take market advice from me. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Chipotle reported earnings after the bell today. Lots of people eating lots of fast casual Mexican. In-store sales for the company up 17% in the first quarter. Digital sales up, get this, 134%. In a pandemic year when more than 110,000 restaurants closed, some with deep pockets like Chipotle and a lot of experience with takeout and online ordering like Chipotle actually grew. Chipotle finished 2020 with something like 150 more restaurants than they had going in, and it now has plans to open hundreds more in the near term. So last week, with the economy and the restaurant industry, it seems, turning a corner, I talked to Chipotle CEO Brian Niccol.
The thing that is most challenging for us is continuing to be able to hire, retain great people that are passionate about our purpose. We're, you know, 85, 90,000 employees, you know, in the not too distant future, we'll have 100,000 and then 200,000. And, you know, the challenge is how do you keep the culture and the purpose alive and well in every single restaurant with every single leader?
Do I hear you saying it's tough to hire in an economy where we're down 8.5 million jobs and unemployment's at 6%?
You know, what's interesting is we have a lot of applicants that come into the business. One of the things I think that they get surprised by is, you know, this is a true culinary job. This is not a grab something out of the freezer, throw it in the fryer, and on you go. So we don't have a problem with the applicant pool. I think our biggest challenge is getting people trained and up to speed so that they want to stay with us.
How do you, you know, so this is, it's an ill-formed question, but look, and you'll probably take offense, but in a lot of people's books, Chipotle is fast food, right? It's basically McDonald's, maybe a step up. And I hear you here making a really strong case, trying to sell it as, you know, as something more than that. And I wonder how you fight the common perception.
Yeah, look, so Steve Ells, who founded the company, he had a really simple idea, which is fast food can be delicious and great food. It doesn't have to be in those old paradigms of what people would qualify fast food as. So it's my job, frankly, our company's job to better explain that to people that when you're making a choice at Chipotle, you're choosing food done differently. And I don't know if you saw this, we just issued our sustainability report. And I do believe this point. It's like how we grow our food will dictate how we create our future. Mm-hmm. And the more we can be convicted in doing the right things around growing food, we're going to end up with better food outcomes throughout the entire supply chain, which I think ultimately means a better future.
You mentioned your sustainability report, and I want to turn for a second to corporate responsibility. And I want to ask about the movement now to get corporations involved in the voting rights issue.
and opposing legislation that seeks to curtail voting rights. As you know, Ken Chenault and Ken Frazier of American Express and Merck have offered that public letter a number of days ago in the Washington Post and the New York Times, calling on corporations to get more involved and take a stand. And I couldn't help but notice Chipotle did not sign that letter, and I want to know why.
You know, it never made it to us. What I can tell you is, you know, we fully believe everybody should have the right to vote, should have access to voting. And, you know, those barriers shouldn't exist. And it's the foundation of our democracy. I think it's what makes our country so great. We strongly believe that everybody needs to have access to voting.
What do you believe? Just sorry, one more question along these lines, and then I'll get out of here. Do you believe this is an appropriate role for companies to play in this economy?
Well, look, I think what is definitely true is I think companies need to be accountable for the values that they push through their culture, the way that they make their decisions. You know, I think you're going to continue to see companies be forward facing in this idea of doing the right thing for the community, the individual, as much as doing the right thing for the business. And I think you can do both. It really frustrates me when it gets, you know, reported or the belief is you can't do both. I think we're an example of a company that does do both. And I just think that's going to be the way forward. And more people are going to be held accountable to doing the right thing.
Brian Niccol is the CEO of Chipotle. Mr. Niccol, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
The soccer world has been swirling with emotions these past 48 hours. Anger, disbelief, and then today, no small amount of mockery. The European Super League, which would have been an oh-so-profitable alliance of a dozen of the world's best, richest, and most popular teams, has collapsed in on itself. Why? And why the angst and outrage from fans and soccer officials alike? Here to explain is soccer fan and marketplace reporter Jasmine Garst.
European soccer has a pyramid system. There's different levels or leagues, and any team can climb up or down in the ranking. The Super League would have changed that. Chris Bauerbank hosts the English soccer podcast, Across the Pond. He says it would be like if
the NCAA said, hey, you know what? We're going to have a super conference, and we're going to take Alabama football, Ohio State football, and only those teams can compete for a national championship.
In fact, it would have Americanized European soccer. Pat Nevin used to play for Chelsea, one of the proposed Super League teams. He points out that baseball and American football,
it's franchises, and it doesn't matter how bad a season you are, you're still in the league next season. That is not the case in Europe. And it's something that in Europe we hold dear to our hearts.
Having the same popular teams in a league every year would have meant a lot more money for some, says Andy Zimbalist, a sports economist at Smith College.
There would be more following, there'd be more traditional rivalries. And as a result of that, they would get larger television contracts.
That's Chelsea fans protesting Tuesday. Coaches, players, even politicians opposed this. And by last night, the Super League dissolved. Zimbalist and others say a lot of these clubs are owned by foreign billionaires, including Americans, who don't entirely understand the culture of soccer, especially this. When it comes to what's known as the beautiful game, don't mess with the fans. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Oh, wait, we don't need to be doing things that way anymore.
No, you don't. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 316 today, 0.9%, 34,137. The NASDAQ ascended 163 points, nearly 1.2% there, 13,950. The S&P 538 points to the good, 0.9%, 41,073. As Marielle was telling us, weaker than expected subscriber growth in the first quarter led investors to sell. Netflix shares plunged 7.4%.
The burden of saving for a mortgage down payment is more onerous for people of color. That is A, obvious, and B, according to a new analysis from the Center for Responsible Lending. Going by national median incomes, it would take 14 years for black household renters to come up with a 5% down payment and closing costs. That's for a home price of $321,500. By the way, for white renters, just 9 years. The reasons, you know them: economic inequality, discrimination, and predatory lending as well. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are still a very long ways from understanding how the economy is going to have changed long term because of this pandemic. That said, there have been some hints of those changes since back in the early days of this thing, most of them having to do with how we feed ourselves, how we shop for food, and where we go to get fed. That's true here, and it is true globally. From London, the BBC's Victoria Craig has that one.
During the COVID-19 lockdown, this sound has become the norm for so many of us. The doorbell rings, and a big box of fresh produce, groceries, or takeout shows up at your door. Hi. A year ago, though, how that online food order arrived was a logistical nightmare for many businesses.
We started with a box, WhatsApped it to a few people, and it kind of went viral from there.
That's Nick Fowler, founder of British food supplier Smith & Brock. Until last March, the company's clients were only of the commercial variety, so hotels, pubs, restaurants, and schools. But when the hospitality sector was forced to close because of lockdown, Fowler and his team were in a rush to offload produce before it went bad. Direct-to-consumer was the only option, and it boomed.
We were doing the same amount of revenue at the start of lockdown that we were doing to hotels and restaurants, but we were doing a heck of a lot more deliveries than what we would have normally been doing. So logistically, it was quite challenging getting it all out.
Now, with about 20% of their corporate clients out of business, that model is what's keeping Smith & Brock not only alive, but thriving. The range has grown from basic fruit and veg boxes to gourmet options like a steak dinner for two, cheese and charcuterie, even a collaboration with one of London's top seafood restaurants. Now, Fowler says there's no going back to the wholesale-only business model.
It's a kind of change for the good, really. So I think it's given people a bit more time to think about what they're buying and how they're buying it. Buy more locally, be more involved and interested in what suppliers we use.
It's a change the wider hospitality industry is seeing as well.
It's the first day. It's all happening now.
The founders of London's Honey & Co. restaurant have just thrown open their doors after a tough three-month lockdown. The joy from owner Itamar Cerulovic is palpable, even over the phone.
We have an amazing clientele base who really rallied around us, and there's no words to describe that feeling. People writing us proper, real letters. They send us flowers. Like, who sends flowers to a restaurant?
In the same way grocers like Smith & Brock pivoted to a direct-to-consumer business last spring, Cerulovic and his wife launched Heat & Eat meal kits that they delivered nationwide. Their three-course meals included fun extras like a customized Spotify playlist, free additional desserts, even candles and white linen napkins for Valentine's Day. Honey & Co.'s owners hope to keep this new slice of the business alive.
And there's so much knowledge that we've gained. Like, how do you pack hundreds of meals on the same day? How do you send them all? It's a real valuable skill that we've developed. So it'll be a shame to let it go to waste.
As more of the UK economy reopens from a third national lockdown, companies have to decide whether to switch up their supply chains again or continue pandemic-proofing their operations against another potential wave of the virus. But it appears businesses are feeling optimistic about their futures. A recent survey from IHS Markit shows 4 in 10 businesses are looking to hire more staff over the next year, and corporate spending plans are at some of their highest levels since the pandemic began. For Honey & Co., all of this means finding a way to continue offering meal kit boxes while maintaining 3 London restaurants. And for Smith & Brock, it means investing in a new physical produce shop to hold on to the customers they've won over during lockdown. In London, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
There you are early in the morning wandering around with your coffee or your tea or your beverage of choice, wanting to know what's going on in business and economics. David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report have exactly what you're looking for. If a small business has survived this pandemic, so far we should say, it's a fair bet they've got some cash on hand right now because they have, almost by definition, figured out how to buy, sell, or process things that people have needed over the past year. And a lot of those small business owners say that they're spending or they are going to spend that money on business investment, buying new gear, improving facilities. Capital expenditures is what that's called. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, every time a company makes a CapEx, it sets off a chain reaction.
Randy George spent the pandemic thinking up ways he could improve how his Red Hen Bakery and Cafe in Vermont does business.
There's all kinds of things that we do in our daily lives or in our businesses that are like, oh, wait, we don't need to be doing things that way anymore.
Like slicing meat and cheese manually for sandwiches, or putting loaves of bread into an oven by hand. So as his business kept humming along during the pandemic, George bought an automatic slicer and an automatic bread loading machine.
To get it into the oven, which was just kind of grunt work before, this thing does that mechanically.
Which means?
You won't go home feeling like your shoulder got ripped off.
The machine we're talking about is a $30,000 conveyor belt on a track that rolls back and forth in front of an oven and slides the loaves in, like this one near San Diego. George bought his loader from TMB Baking, a commercial equipment supplier in San Francisco. Owner Greg Warwick says he's been selling a lot of equipment lately.
It's been a swell that's been, I wouldn't call it a tsunami, but you can see the waves coming at you. And that's why we've been very pleased and grateful again that we've been seeing an uptick.
That uptick from bakers like Randy George is giving Warwick's company more money to spend on inventory. More ovens, more dough mixers, more machines that divide dough, and more parts for what Warwick says has been a big seller lately, retarder proofers.
We purchase all the components and do all the assembly for those in our facility, and we also build the controls and the wiring.
Retarder proofers are insulated chambers used to prep dough before baking. They're part cooler to slow the yeast down and part proofer to warm the dough up. Warwick says he's been selling proofers of all sizes.
Everything from a cabinet that just takes individual sheet pans to larger chambers that you can roll multiple racks into.
Warwick's company purchases the walls, ceilings, and doors for those retarder proofers from a manufacturer called Imperial Brown, where Stacy Sewell works.
My division handles food service, so that would be restaurants, schools, hospitals.
And business has been off the charts.
2021, we've broken every sales record that our company has ever had. Keep in mind, we're a 105-year-old company.
Scaling up to meet that demand has not been easy. Supplies have been stuck on ships and congested ports. Insulating foam is in short supply because of the freeze in Texas. Right now, Imperial Brown's factories in Oregon, Oklahoma, and North Carolina are only operating with one shift and barely keeping up. The company used to be able to deliver orders in 3 to 5 weeks, but now...
Our lead times have extended to 6 to 8 weeks across all three factories.
That's meant a lot of employees have been working long hours.
That's not sustainable to keep everybody working overtime day after day, week after week, month after month.
And so?
We really are looking to hire, and that's very important to us.
Adding 120 people to Imperial Brown's 400-person staff. Sewell sees that investment the same way Vermont baker Randy George sees his purchase of the bread loader, as something that will make the company more productive going forward. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, saw this the other day, didn't quite get it and still don't, but it is a good entry in the Jeff Bezos wants to take over the world file. Amazon, which is Bezos's company, of course, is opening a hair salon in London. That's according to the Washington Post, which, oh, by the way, Bezos also owns. There is speculation it's a consumer data play. There's going to be lots of tech at every chair, it seems. I personally, I'm good with the shorter on the sides, take a little off the top approach myself.
All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context. Comes to us courtesy of the American Institute of Architects, making a first-time appearance on this program, I believe, with its Architecture Billings Index, just like it sounds, a measurement of how architects are billing. The news is that it's back in positive territory, the index is, for the first time since February of last year, meaning the number of bills that architects are sending out is going up, not down. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squillace, Charlton Thorpe, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.